Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of old-time radio. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the nostalgic sounds of old-time radio. Don't touch that dial with Bob Lines and Barbara Sunday.
And I thank you, Fred Foy, for getting us started off on yet another edition of the longest continuing old-time radio show west of Chicago.
It only seems like the longest.
It just goes on forever, doesn't it? Well, we're entering our 11th year, I think, here at KPFK, if I'm not mistaken. 2001, the 12th year. And our 39th year. We're actually wrapping up our 39th year of Don't Touch That Dial.
That's what Jack Benny said.
Jack Benny. Can you believe that? My gosh. I have some sad news. Barbara is not with us tonight. She's nursing a cold that she thinks is coming on, and so she just better to stay at home, and we'll carry on without her. She's a very important part. As a matter of fact, Barbara is the producer and has been the producer of Don't Touch That Dial since 1980.
You're the has-been. She's the producer.
That's right. I'm the old. Yeah, I'm the Star is Born. What was his name?
Norman Maine.
I'm the Norman Maine, and she's the
Judy Garland
part. Yes, Barbara has done such a wonderful job and still continues to do such a great job putting these shows together every month. And tonight, we're going to start off for the first hour or so with a very special occasion, because not only do we believe in old radio, we believe in new radio, too, and some of the things that have come along over the years have been due to a friend of ours who is very involved in new radio and has been for many, many years himself, and I'm very proud to have him here tonight, our friend Roger Rittner. Welcome, Roger.
Roger, can you come in now?
Yes, applaud, yes.
Thanks, Bob. I was trying to remember, Bob, how many years ago, we're talking about longevity.
Variety arts.
How many years ago we actually stumbled over each other and became good friends.
Yeah.
And it has to be at least 25 years.
Yeah. Back to when you were doing the live shows at Variety Arts. I remember coming over there and watching you do that and saying, Roger, you ought to get these on the air. And eventually you did. You did a great couple of episodes, couple of serials in the Doc Savage Adventures back in the 80s. And boy, oh boy, that was quite a kick because I was a Doc Savage fan. And to be involved in something like that after all the years of reading the books and things like that, it was quite a thrill for me to get to be the pronouncer on that show.
And we did that when we were young and stupid and didn't even know what we were doing.
And it came off very well, and you're to be congratulated for that. But you have not been left resting on your laurels or your stands either.
Or anything.
Or Hardee's, yes. You've been very busy doing other things, and you're involved in kind of bringing some of the old pulp magazines to audio.
Well, if you remember, a couple of years ago, you kindly had me on the show to talk about this wild idea that I came up with of actually doing full cast audio versions of the original pulp stories from the 1930s and 40s, and that has been going very well. But I always wanted to do a long form, maybe find a really interesting novel in the pulp vein that would allow us to expand what we were doing rather than just the short stories. And it actually happened that a number of people that I had known for many, many years kind of came back into the fold, if you will. Will Ryan was one. Ian Whitcomb was another.
Yeah.
Robin Riker, who's sitting far too far away from me.
Let me cuddle up. Radio, you can't tell what we're doing.
Exactly.
Robin, you can get off my lap.
Trot
it over to Roger.
But Will and I, as some of you may know, Will is the front man for an absolutely fabulous local band called the Cactus County Cowboys.
Here.
And we produced a one-hour musical western, and we needed a kind of a British foil for Will, and Will said, well, what about Ian Whitcomb, who I've known for years and years, and Will has known for years and years? And so Ian was in that and did a marvelous job, and after we had completed it, I said to Ian, is there anything you'd like to do? Well, that touched a nerve because Ian has been one of the biggest fans of the Bulldog Drummond character for many, many years. And he said, you know, I've read Bulldog Drummond on radio, but I've loved to do it as a full cast audio production.
Mm-hmm.
And being somewhat naive, and I said, okay. And I had read Bulldog Drummond years and years and years ago, and so I went back and read it again, and I realized what I'd let myself in for, because it is one of the original action-adventure novels of the 20th century. There have been so many characters that Bulldog Drummond has influenced. Ian Fleming said that Bulldog Drummond was one of the main prototypes for James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Lester Dent said that a lot of the structure of the Doc Savage stories were based on Bulldog Drummond. And, of course, there are so many pulp heroes that you can trace back to Bulldog Drummond. He really was a breakout character in the 1920s that got action fiction out of the Sherlock Holmes era.
The deduction type of
The deduction, and into the action hero era that led into actually the pulps of the late 1920s and 30s and on into the 40s.
The golden age of those, yes.
Yeah, and in fact, Bulldog Drummond books were still being written in the 1950s. So it was kind of interesting to go back to this original action-adventure character and see what we could make into a full-length audio drama. As I was doing my research, I found that a number of audio books had been done of the novel with a narrator reading the books. But as far as I could tell, no one had ever done a full-cast scripted version of it. So I'm sure someone will pop up and say, oh, yeah, you know, the BBC did that in 1925.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. So in any case, we decided to go for it, and it turned out to be a 5.25-hour full-on novel-length action-adventure. And I'm not being too modest to say everybody who's heard it thinks it just turned out very well. So we're very excited. We just released it right before Christmas, and a lot of people who are hearing it are very excited about it.
Yeah, I wish we could have had you on before Christmas. We might have increased some sales.
I understand there's a Christmas coming up this year.
Yes, there'll be another one along.
Oh,
yes,
good.
Yes.
And take the tree down.
Let me introduce the people who are sitting to my left and right, two of the most important cast members of the show after Ian.
Ian couldn't be with us, by the way.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, the two people who are with us tonight are, in addition to Bulldog Drummond, probably the two most important continuing characters in the Bulldog Drummond canon of stories. One is the major villain of the piece, Carl Peterson. And Carl Peterson was created kind of in the vein of Professor Moriarty and other
arch nemesis,
and
Captain Jack Quartz, nemesis of Nick Carter.
Yes, yes.
And
as
most of your listeners would know.
That role went to someone I've known a long, long time, Mr. Bentley Barlock, who is sitting on my left.
Yes, hello, everyone.
And
deliciously villain.
Yeah, one of the most infamous femme fatales of British fiction was created in the original Bulldog Drummond book. Her name was Irma, and her relationship to Carl Peterson is never quite stated explicitly.
It's rather hazy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I could think of no one better than my old and dear friend Robin Riker to play that, and Robin's here on my right.
You're here.
So.
Yay. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
Now she's on your right.
I brought along an excerpt. In addition to the Bulldog Drummond audio adventure we've done is in 24 chapters, but to fill out the sixth CD in our CD set, Ian recorded some reminiscences and a bit of history about the Bulldog Drummond character. And I thought, just to give a brief background to the character, we could play a part of one of the bonus tracks in the set, which talks about how Herman Cyril McNeil, who went under the pseudonym of Sapper, came to create the character.
A few words about Sapper, the pen name of Herman Cyril McNeil. He was born in 1888, a year after my grandfather, in Cornwall, where his father, Captain McNeil, was governor of the naval prison on Bodmin Moor. He loathed his Christian names and told everybody to call him Mac. After prep school on the Sussex coast near Mine, he was sent to a decent, not the tops, public school, Cheltenham College. Then, instead of Oxford or Cambridge, he went to the Royal Military Academy, not as prestigious as Sandhurst. When war broke out in 1914, Mac was there in the British Expeditionary Force, where he quickly rose to captain. But not as a leader of frontline troops with bayonet and rifle, but as an engineer, building bridges, setting up mines and so forth. He stayed the course from start to finish, never badly wounded, although he was gassed. By the end, he was a lieutenant colonel with a wife and two sons. Bored by the inertia of being an engineer, he started scribbling. His first writing appeared in a horse racing paper. Then, utilizing his observation of men under fire and how they reacted, he sent some stories to the Daily Mail, a mass circulation newspaper. Lord Northcliffe, the owner, recognized Mac's writings as the real McCoy, much more authentic than his own coddled correspondence. He published the stories, but gave Mac a pseudonym, Sapper, because he was in the Royal Engineers, and that was their nickname. A collection of short stories, Sergeant Michael Cassidy, R.E., was published in 1915. By war's end, it had sold well over 100,000 copies. Many critics rated Sapper as the best popular war writer. He had not been trying to be a poet like Siegfried Sassoon or Wilfred Owen. He was simply speaking plainly to a mass public, to like-minded people who might enjoy reading about the real war, albeit wrapped up in the clothing of fiction. So, after the war, in 1919, as a perplexingly chaotic peace broke out and Mac gave up professional soldiering as an impotent exercise, he was well set up as a professional writer with a top agent and a solid publisher. The book, Bulldog Drummond, was turned out at high speed, and when published in 1920, it quickly became a bestseller. Bulldog's violent punishments were just the sort of simple solution embraced by a public confused and concerned about the sudden rash of strikes, of recessions, and reports that the Bolsheviks who had taken over Russia were hell-bent on taking over the rest of the world. With oodles of the money made off the first novel, the McNeil clan expatriated themselves to Switzerland in 1922, only returning to Britain in 1931 when the country went off the gold standard. Mac never stopped writing. Every day, and never less than 1,000 words before he could relax at golf, tennis, hunting, and yarning with his pals at the club, pipe in hand and strong ale at his elbow. He was a simple, upright English gentleman with no dark side, apparently. He never saw himself as an intellectual or a literary man. Introducing The Black Gang, which was the sequel to Bulldog Drummond, he told his readers, "I hope it will amuse people as Bulldog seems to have done. I lay no claims to either of them being literature with a capital L. As long as they pass an hour or two agreeably, they have fulfilled their purpose." H.C. McNeil died of throat cancer in 1937, a month short of his 49th birthday. His close friend Gerard Fairley, the fellow Mac agreed might have been the model for Bulldog Drummond, continued the series until the 1950s. And then it was time for James Bond and the Beatles. The fighting British gentleman had been mothballed, but we have dressed him up again for your delight.
That's Bulldog Drummond himself, Ian Whitcomb, who could not be with us tonight, but he was there by recording.
Well, we'll hear a lot of Ian, because yes, as the lead character, of course, he is in virtually every chapter in the story. I must say that putting the script together was really a challenge, because as was true of many detective and the emerging action stories of the 1920s, it was heavy on narration. And, of course, the essence of audio drama is dialogue. So it was really a challenge to take the narration and the essence of the storyline and try to create dialogue that told the story, yet sound natural and not make it sound like a narrator telling.
So you had to come up with some dialogue.
Yeah. I think it turned out pretty good, but I'd like to turn to Bentley and to Robin to talk about how they developed their characters based on the script that we had produced.
Well, first of all, I'd say in the original draft where you had that character who did all the exposition and was it was a sidekick character of Ian's, of Bulldog's, mm-hmm. who would just stand there and talk to Bulldog and describe everything. It was just kind of odd. And I have to say, Roger, in his infinite wisdom, in the second draft, removed that character.
Discarded that,
it's
yes.
just yes. so much more fun that way and more action-packed, I
it's
thought.
It's funny now, too, because quite the opposite seemed to be in the part of Bulldog's major domo at the place he's staying now, because he just, a lot of time, he'll just stand around and his contribution, Bulldog will tell something, and he'll go, quiet, you know. And then Bulldog's off.
Another thing, I refer to the ambiguity between mm-hmm. Carl Peterson and Irma, and I appreciate the fact that you've maintained that, and by eliminating a lot of the exposition and the narration,
the mystery,
it's even more filled with potential.
Yes, it is that. I'm looking forward to that.
You know, Carl Peterson, the character that Bentley plays, is truly probably the next generation of Professor Moriarty. Very slick, very intelligent, very vicious, and his machinations, particularly in this first story to try to turn England into a communist country, I think plays very well to Bentley's ability to be very smooth and yet very sinister.
Well, I don't know if you're referring to the problems I had with HUAC back in the 50s. And I did not have a green card at the time, either. So that was rather distressing. But I don't think we use the word communist in the script at all, right?
No,
this character simply hates England at all for which it stands.
Well, one of the things that I did not believe in, and some of the criticisms of at least the first few Bulldog Drummond stories are, is that for the time, they were quite jingoistic, and there were a lot of references to certain character types mm-hmm. that today we would find extremely offensive. And the stories have gotten a lot of criticism over the years because of that, but as you read the stories, those references are in little pockets, and they're easy to write out or write around. So we fortunately got around that. This is a scene in which Bentley as Carl Peterson and Ian as Bulldog have realized that they are now at odds, and it's going to be one against the other for the rest of the story. This is from an early episode where Drummond and Peterson face off over breakfast.
Your car is a little early, Captain Drummond. However, it can wait 2 or 3 minutes while we get matters perfectly clear. I should dislike you not knowing where you stand.
Do tell.
Against my advice, you have deliberately elected to fight me in the interests I represent. So be it. From now on, the gloves are off. You embarked on this course from a spirit of adventure, at the instigation of the girl next door. The poor little fool is concerned over that drunken waster, her father. She asked you to help her. You agreed. And amazing though it may seem, up to now you have scored a certain measure of success.
Well,
I admit it, and I admire you for it. I apologize now for having played the fool with you last night. You're the type of man whom one should kill outright, or leave alone. You're also the type of man who will continue on the path he has started. You are completely in the dark. You have no idea whatever what you are up against.
Not yet. But I'll...
You stupid young fool! Do you really imagine that you can beat me?
I have a few remarks of my own to make, and then we might consider the interview closed. I ask nothing better than that the gloves should be off, though with your filthy methods of fighting, anything you touch will get very dirty. As you say, I am completely in the dark as to your plans, but I have a pretty shrewd idea what I'm up against. Men who can employ a thumbscrew on a poor defenseless innocent seem to me to be several degrees worse than a cannibal. And if I rank you as one of the lowest types of degraded criminal, I shall not be very wide of the mark.
Is that all?
Only one thing more. You have kindly warned me of my danger, so let me give you a word of advice in return. I'm going to fight you. And if I can, I'm going to beat you. Anything that may happen to me is part of the game. But if anything happens to Miss Benton during the course of operations, then as surely as there is a God above, Peterson, I'll get at you somehow and murder you with my own hands.
Quite melodramatic.
And very bad for the digestion so early in the morning. My regards to your charming daughter. Shall we meet again soon?
Very soon, young man. Very soon indeed.
Then good morning. And don't forget, it was you who pulled off the gloves.
Oh, there's trouble brewing there.
Yes. I love the music. It's so evocative.
Sets the scenes. Yes.
I was telling Bob earlier that I really wanted to make this sound like, first of all, like a true audio drama from the 1930s.
Sure.
But I also wanted it to be evocative of the period of the 20s. And so most, I won't say all, but most of the music throughout the whole book
was conducted personally by Roger. And I think he's so modest about it. Ian did conduct some of it and did write some of the music we've heard even this very evening, right?
Yeah, as I was going to say, most of the background music is actually British radio drama music from the 30s and 40s.
Oh.
But we have interpolated a lot of Ian's period music into the show, and in fact...
And Ian knows his period music,
yes,
too.
Yes, he does.
He's a great musicologist and an entertainer, and writes music and wrote some of the music in this.
Sings and plays.
And sings and plays to this very day.
Well, I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about Irma. She's called Irma Peterson, although whether she's actually related to Carl Peterson or not is kind of left unsaid.
Oh, there's definitely a relationship.
Yes. Oh, yes, not there's relating going on.
And she's not to be confused with Irma Peterson, my friend Irma.
No, completely different.
Different story.
As I said, Irma is considered one of the first real femme fatales of British fiction, and I could think of no one better to turn to play it than someone I've known for a long, long time, although she's still extraordinarily young and beautiful.
God, yes.
God love her. Your check is in the mail.
Robin, as you mentioned earlier, Bob, was
Pat Savage in
the Doc Savage Adventures we did in 1985. And in that case, she was a very tomboyish, go-for-it, gung-ho young lady. But she has an extremely... Not Pat, Robin, has an extremely wide range, and I knew she'd be great for character of Irma. It's hard to pin her down. You never quite know whose side she's on.
Mm-hmm.
And although at one moment she can be trying to seduce Drummond in the bedroom of the Peterson estate, and the next moment she's running out to the yard to watch him try to be shot off the roof after he escapes.
She's moody.
Oh.
She's moody.
So you approach that beautifully, and I thought that just the right touch of sensuousness but also evil in the character.
Well, you know, she kind of comes to a slow boil. You know, that's what I found, was that you meet her and you think you know a little bit, and then you know a little more, and she's kind of in the background a little bit, and then all of a sudden she'll just jump right out at you, you know? And that's the most fun sort of character to play.
Had you ever done anything like that?
Well, with...
Drama.
Well, all the work that I've done with you, I mean, Roger and I have worked together for ages, and doing and all of the radio theater things that we did, I know I did, you know, and the shadows and all those things, you know, I know I did, because, and that's one of the thrills of doing these books or any radio drama is you can meet anyone. I mean, with Roger, I've played everything from an 8-year-old Chinese boy to an 80-year-old quadriplegic. It's been fabulous. She comes alarmingly naturally to me, shall I say.
And Irma is one of the continuing characters. There were actually a couple dozen Bulldog Drummond books written. Carl Peterson appears in the first four, but Irma takes over in the fifth book and becomes the principal antagonist against Drummond. And I can't wait to get to book number five. So
neither can I. Early retirement.
But just to give you some sense of how well Robin plays this very seductive character, Drummond has been captured by Peterson, and who knows what villainy lies upstairs in the mansion, but he asks Irma to take Drummond upstairs, and the way up is a very interesting scene.
Irma, is the blue room ready?
All ready.
Tell Luigi to show Captain Drummond to it.
I'll show him myself, and then I shall go to bed. Oh, my God, but I find this country boring. Upstairs.
Your house is most beautifully furnished, Irma. Thick carpets, solid furniture.
Tell me, you ugly man, why are you such a fool?
I must remember that opening. I feel convinced that many people would like to say it on first meeting me, but confine themselves to merely thinking it. It does establish a basis of intimacy at once, does it not?
Here. Yeah. Don't you understand? They'll kill you. Go, you idiot. Go while there's time.
Time for what?
Oh, if I could only make you understand. If you'd only believe me. Get out of it. Go abroad. Do anything. But don't fool around here.
It seems a cheerful household. Why are you all so concerned about me? Your father gave me the same advice yesterday morning.
Don't ask why. I can't tell you. Only you must believe that what I say is the truth. You must. It's just possible that if you tell them where you've hidden the American and go now, you'll be all right. But if you don't... Breakfast will be at 9. Until then, au revoir. Good night, Carl.
Good night, my dear.
Listening at keyholes, Mr. Peterson?
Good night, Captain Drummond.
That was me on the kettle drums.
You're brilliant. We're nothing without you.
If you just tuned in, let me remind everybody, you're listening to Don't Touch That Dial. We're talking about new time radio instead of old time radio right now. Our special guest in studio is Roger Rittner, who has produced this brand new full cast audio drama based on the adventures of Bulldog Drummond. Roger.
Thanks. The cast of characters is huge. The number of characters in this book numbers about 35. Yes. And I don't think I'm letting any cats out of the bag when I say that our host, Mr. Lines, played a number of the characters, and very well, too.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
But Carl Peterson has to have some muscle. I mean, Peterson is the brains, and he needs some muscle, so he enlists a character named Henry Lakington, who has interesting hobbies. He is a scientist, he is also a burglar, and he is a an obtainer of antiquities and valuables that don't necessarily belong to him. But it's a very interesting scene. Drummond gets pulled into this adventure because he answers an ad in the newspaper from a Phyllis Benton, who is worried for her father, who has come under the sway of Peterson and Lakington. And they meet for tea at the Carlton Hotel, and Lakington happens to drop by. So this is the scene in which Drummond meets Henry Lakington, who is played by a marvelous, marvelous actor, Michael McConaughey, one of the best voice actors in L.A., I think.
That's great.
So here's where Drummond first gets to know Henry Lakington.
Don't look around. Tell me your name, quickly.
Drummond. Captain Hugh Drummond, DSO MC, late of His Majesty's Royal Loamshires.
My dear Phyllis, this is a pleasant surprise. I had no idea that you were in London.
The world is full of such surprises, isn't it? I don't suppose you know Captain Drummond, do you? Mr. Henry Lakington, art connoisseur and a collector.
I do not remember ever having heard my harmless pastimes more concisely described. Are you interested in such matters, Captain?
I want a voice like that.
Not very, I'm afraid. Just recently I've been rather too busy to pay much attention to art.
Of course, you've been in France. Unfortunately, a bad heart kept me on this side of the water. I regret it in many ways. Regret it immensely. Sometimes I cannot help thinking how wonderful it must have been to be able to kill without fear of consequences. Well, there is art in killing, Captain Drummond. Profound art. And as you know, Phyllis, I've always been greatly attracted by anything requiring the artistic touch.
Yes.
Alas, I must tear myself away. Are you returning home to the country this evening?
Probably. I haven't quite decided. I might stop with Aunt Kate.
Fortunate Aunt Kate. Good afternoon.
What's the matter, dear girl? Are you feeling faint?
I'm quite all right. It just gave me a shock. That man finding us here.
On the face of it, it seems a harmless occupation.
On the face of it, perhaps. But that man doesn't deal with face values. You've stumbled right into the middle of it, my friend, rather sooner than I anticipated. Henry Lakington is one of the men you will probably have to kill.
Zoot.
Hello.
You know, you mentioned, Bob, that Bulldog Drummond was a radio series, actually in both Britain and in America. It's interesting that being the prototype action-adventure hero, when he went on radio and in the motion pictures as well, he sort of just became a run-of-the-mill detective.
Pretty much, yes. There was nothing, none of this pulp adventure extent to it, yes.
Yeah.
Not that it wasn't entertaining, it was just different.
No, it was a very successful radio program in America. It lasted from about 1941, I think, to 48, 49.
Yeah, around 48, I believe.
But it's interesting that the two dichotomies of approach to the story. Interestingly enough, most of the Bulldog Drummond films of the 30s were 30s-style detective, almost B movies, and it wasn't until the 1960s that they turned Drummond back around, and he sort of became a super spy. There were a couple of films in the 1960s, particularly one called Deadlier Than the Mail, where he actually was a spy superhero.
More like James Bond.
Yeah, well, it followed the James Bond phenomenon.
Right.
But it's interesting that we are playing the books as they were originally conceived as action adventures. They're, a little more interesting because detectives are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
or $100 a day. That's about it.
Yeah. And Drummond's relationship with Phyllis Benton, who is the woman who has hired him to try to save her father from the clutches of Peterson and Lakington, is in the first book, she is sort of just window dressing. She's there to be saved, as they sometimes say.
Be careful, Bulldog.
Yes, right. And unfortunately, she only appears in a few chapters. Marvelous actress named Jean Gilpin plays Phyllis in our production.
Yeah, and she's lovely.
And yeah. She brought a real depth of character to Phyllis, because not only was she the damsel in distress, but there were a couple of occasions when she actually took it upon herself and went after Lakington and Peterson and actually attacked them in a couple of chapters. At the end of the first book, Drummond and Phyllis actually get married, but that doesn't take her out of the danger, because on all the rest of the books, she's either captured or kidnapped or held for ransom or something.
Still in distress, apparently.
Right. He could pick 'em.
Drummond falls for Phyllis almost immediately and make their feelings known to each other. Phyllis and Drummond are on their way back to her home. He has been captured and escaped and captured again and escaped again. And as heroes often do, they don't tell their better half anything about it until it's too late. But in this scene, they're driving, and what turns out to be just a recap scene turns into something a little bit more.
What is this very important matter you want to talk to me about?
I'll tell you when we get out on the Hog's Back. It's absolutely vital.
Let's stop. You can tell me here.
You're not fair. I haven't swerved like that since I first started to drive.
Tell me about this important thing.
You darling, you adorable darling.
You mustn't. Oh, Hugh, you mustn't.
And why not?
But look, there's a man over there in the field. He'll see.
See what? That I love you, Phyllis? I do. I just love you.
But it's only 2 or 3 days since we met.
And what the devil has that got to do with it? Would I want longer to decide such an obvious fact? Tell me, don't you care just a little?
But we've got other things to do. We can't think of love.
Yes, we can.
Cars pass here with great regularity. I know you'd hate to be discovered in this position.
Would I? I wonder.
Would I? Is that good enough?
I suppose we'd better descend to trivialities. My lads and I have had lots of fun and games since I last saw you a year or two ago.
Oh, idiot boy. It was yesterday morning.
Mere facts don't count when it's you and me. To resume, I regret to state that Peterson has got POTS.
Oh, Hugh, how did they manage it?
I'm damned if I know. They found out that he was in my bungalow at Goring during the afternoon by sending round a man to see about the water. Somehow or other, he must have doped the drink or the food, because after dinner we all fell asleep.
Oh, Hugh!
Yes, I can just remember seeing Lakington's face outside in the garden, pressed against the window, and then everything went out. I don't remember anything more till I woke this morning with the most appalling headache. Of course, Potts was gone.
I heard the car drive up in the middle of the night. Do you think he's at the Elms now?
Well, that's what I propose to find out tonight. We've staged a little comedy for Peterson's benefit, and we're hoping for the best.
What's it all about, Hugh? What are they doing?
Whatever it is, it's a tough proposition. They're absolutely without scruple, and their power seems unlimited. I know that they're after the Duchess of Lampshire's pearls.
How did you fathom that?
And I found the beautiful Irma consuming tea with young Laidley yesterday. You know, the Duke's eldest son. But there's something more in the wind than that, Phyllis. Unless I'm a dunce of the first water, it's an infinitely larger proposition than that.
Oh, do be careful. I'd never forgive myself if anything happened to you. I'd feel it was all due to me. And I just couldn't bear it.
Dear little girl, you're simply adorable when you look like that. But not even for you would I back out of this show now. It's gone altogether too far, and they've shown themselves to be so completely beyond the pale that it's got to be fought out. And when it has been, and we've won, why, then, girl of mine, we'll get Peter Darrell to be best man.
Oh, Hugh.
There's some romance in there, too, yes.
Sure, absolutely,
yes.
Oh, Hugh.
Before we go on, there are a couple of really interesting announcements to make. Mm-hmm. One is that Bentley Barlock, having done a terrific job as Carl Peterson, will not be Carl Peterson in the future.
Oh. That is correct. I was joking about early retirement after the fifth adventure, but I'll be retiring from... At least I won't be able to do the role in the next one, because I know Roger's been working on it. I know when it's scheduled to be recorded, and I will be out of the country doing other things.
Oh, Bentley, how shall I survive?
Well, who will we get to replace him?
I think we could discuss that perhaps a little bit later in the show.
Yes, right. Yeah. In fact, I think if he arrives in time, we may be able to announce who will be taking over the role.
Is the lad coming?
Yeah, it might be.
Very good.
My new daddy.
But I did enjoy it very much, Roger, I do want to say. And later on we'll be discussing a protege of mine who I believe will be filling in for the part of Carl Peterson.
Right, yes. And the other big announcement is Robin is an authoress and has a new book almost coming out, called A Survivor's Guide to Hollywood, How to Play the Game Without Losing Your Soul.
Oh.
Yes, I'm very excited about
it. You've got 30 seconds to plug it.
Go to robinreicher.com, sign up for when it'll be out in the spring.
Some listeners might want to know how to spell Reicher.
I was just thinking that. Thank you, Bentley. You're such a darling. Well, Robin is with an I, and Reicher is like the island. So it's robinreicher.com.
Very good.
And it'll be out this spring.
Yes, this spring. And also at robinreicher.com, there's a link to Bulldog Drummond.
Funny you should bring that up.
Oh, good.
And why don't we talk about how folks can actually get one of
these. If you actually wanted to hear one of these shows.
Yes actually.
Now, I love the title.
My turn.
Yes, you go.
Bulldog Drummond is a 6-CD set with the 5.5-hour, 24-chapter adventure, as well as a couple of bonus tracks, including the longer version of the history of Bulldog Drummond that Ian recorded. And it is available at pulpradio.net. We're also on Facebook at Pulp Radio Network. It is a marvelous gift.
Yes.
And it's actually, I think, a rather impressive package.
It's a beautiful package, just the amount of time one needs to go from Los Angeles to New York on a plane, you know, so you can be thoroughly entertained without...
Or to motor car up to Vancouver.
Indeed, exactly, yes.
Either Vancouver, yeah, ours or theirs, yes.
Okay, enough of the commercials.
Okay.
Despite scenes of confrontation and romance, there are some action scenes. Drummond has a great habit of leaping with both feet into any situation that presents himself, usually without thinking. And later in the story, as we said, Phyllis actually does get kidnapped. And by this time, an American detective named Mr. Green has been on the trail of Carl Peterson as well. This scene is where Drummond realizes that Phyllis has been kidnapped and races to rescue her, probably with not the best intentions in mind.
Here we are, Mr. Green. This is my little rabbit hutch. Now let me find my latch key.
Thank the Lord you've come. There's something doing down at Godalming I don't like.
Peter, what's on?
At 12 o'clock today, Toby rang up. He was talking quite ordinarily. You know the sort of rot he usually gets off his chest? When suddenly he stopped quite short and said, "My God, what do you want?" I could tell he looked up because his voice was muffled. There was the sound of a scuffle. I heard Toby curse, then nothing more. I rang and rang and rang. No answer.
What did you do?
Algie was here. He motored straight off to see if he could find out what was wrong. I stopped here to tell you.
Anything through from Algie?
Not a word. There's foul play, or I'll eat my hat.
When did his letter come?
An hour ago. I very nearly opened it.
Denny, I want my car at once. If they've hurt one hair of her head, I'll murder that gang one by one with my bare hands.
Captain, may I see the letter? For pity's sake, come at once. The Baroness is trustworthy.
Girl's writing. Do you know her?
My fiancée.
Certain? Certain? Of course I am. I know every curl of her letter.
There is such a thing as forgery.
Damn it, man! Do you imagine I don't know my own girl's writing?
A good many bank cashiers have mistaken their customers' writing before now. I don't like it, Captain. A girl in real trouble wouldn't put in that bit about the bearer.
You go to blazes. I'm going to Godalming.
Well, not knowing Godalming, I don't know who scores. But if you go there, I come too.
And me.
Not you, Peter. If Mr. Green will come, I'll be delighted. But I want you here at headquarters.
The car's ready, sir. You want a bag packed?
No, only my revolver. Are you ready, Mr. Green?
I always am.
Then we'll move.
You missed your vocation, Captain. If you pushed a wheelchair, it'd be safer for all parties.
Quick, to the side door.
Why not try the front door?
Because it's in sight of the other house.
Seems kind of empty.
Right, I'm going to break in. Stand back. Phyllis! Mr. Benton!
No one at home.
Phyllis!
Say, somebody's been roughhousing by the look of things. Looks like a boozing den after a tech night.
It does.
Tablecloth pulled off, telephone on the floor, china and glass smashed to pieces.
And this?
What is it?
Algie Longworth's eyeglass. So he's been caught too.
That came from the house next door.
Phyllis!
Stop, you young fool! Don't go over there!
That was too easy.
So you thought before, Henry, and yet he always bobs up somehow.
Yes, Carl, but this time he catches a glimpse of his woman from the upstairs window. He throws all caution to the winds. He rushes headlong into our trap. A quick sap on the back of the head, and there he lies, unconscious on our entry floor.
Yes. Well, if you take my advice, you'll finish him off here and now and run no further risks.
Kill him while he's unconscious? No, Carl. Not under any circumstances. He has quite a lengthy score to pay, and by God, he's going to pay it this time.
Boy.
Oh, my God. Terrified.
Carl Peterson.
Well, speaking of Carl Peterson, we have the new Carl Peterson has joined us in studio.
Can I? Is this mic on?
Yes. I'd like to introduce one of the best voice actors in the business, Mr. Will Ryan.
Well, thank you, Roger. thanks, everybody, Bob and Robin. I'm happy to be here, and I'm especially happy to be here with Mr. Barlock, whose microphone I'm using.
That's perfectly all right.
And, you know, I've been a fan of Bentley Barlock's for years. And he asked me, because I do a little impression of him in my act, and he comes and sees Will Ryan on the Cactus County Cowboys whenever he's in Los Angeles. And
so do I, yes.
No, that, right. And so I didn't realize he was in the audience, and I did that. And we got to know each other. We spoke afterwards. And he's going to be out of the country when you record the next episodes, and he's asked me to do the voice of Carl Peterson. So I'm going to give it a stab.
Happy to have you. And Will, this is Robin. Your relationship is unspecified.
Yeah. We can make it whatever we want, Will.
I've always felt that and enjoyed that. Great. Wonderful.
Well,
as long as Carl doesn't mind.
Glad to have you.
Or Bentley, for that matter.
You'll be wonderful.
Just a couple of minutes left. I would like to play one more track. We talked about some of the action and adventure and some of the viciousness that was a departure from the previous British literature in Bulldog Drummond. This next short little scene kind of demonstrates just what we're talking about.
In fact, my young friend, the time has come for you to retire for the night. Whilst we deliberate down here on various matters of importance, we shall be thinking of you upstairs. That is to say, if you get there. I see that Lakington is even now beginning to gloat in pleasant anticipation.
Then I will say good night. Oh, is it the same room that I had last time?
No, a different one. Specially prepared for you. If you get to the top of the stairs, a man will show you where it is. Turn out the lights.
I could feel the darkness. Not the faintest glimmer even of grayness showed anywhere. I remained motionless, wondering what the next move was going to be. Behind me in the room, I could hear an occasional movement in one of the chairs. From the hall outside, I caught the sound of whispering. I felt that I was surrounded by men, thronging in on me from all sides. Very cautiously, I began to feel my way towards the door. Then someone brushed past me. My hand shot out and gripped him by the arm. The man wriggled and twisted, but he was powerless as a child. I found his throat with my other hand. I reached the foot of the stairs. I paused. I suddenly remembered the mysterious thing which had whizzed past my head that other night and clanged suddenly into the wall beside me. I had gone up 5 stairs when it had happened, and now my foot was on the first step. If they proposed to drive me mad, it was unlikely they'd kill me on the stairs. It was more likely they'd use it to frighten me. I commenced to climb.
That's 4 steps, Captain Drummond. What about the 5th?
A very good-looking one, as I remember, Peterson. I'm just about to get onto it.
Well, that should prove entertaining. I'd stand quite still if I were you. Just listen.
Peterson, you fool! You've killed him! You've killed Drummond!
Boy, now if that isn't a cliffhanger, I don't
know.
There
you go.
That'll make you come back next week. That's for sure.
Well, Bob, it's been a great fun being on the show. Thanks for
having us. Is it over with already? My gosh. You just got started. Yes. Roger Rittner, thank you very much for coming by.
Oh, always my pleasure.
And bringing your cast of characters, Bentley Barlock and
Speaking.
And Will Ryan.
And I'm still here, too.
Yes.
You can use his mic.
Yes.
You can.
And Robin Riker, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. This is great.
You can find Will online at CactusCountyCowboys.com.
And if you ever see him advertised anywhere, the coffee gallery or wherever, please do attend.
Definitely. Because
he puts on one heck of a
and
show.
And Robin's site, RobinRiker.com. You can pre-order her book.
Yes.
Great.
And, oh, by the way, you can also
get Avon Crawling.
You can also get Bulldog Drummond at pulpradio.net. Or our Facebook page, Pulp Radio Network.
Well, we appreciate you being here tonight, all of you, and we wish you all a very happy new year and very much success with this endeavor, Roger. We hope for the best, that's for sure.
Thanks, Bob, and there's a small part in the next one for you.
Oh, great. I love walk-ons.
Talk-ons.
Yes, talk-ons. That's right. They're called talk-ons.
PulpRadio.net.
Thank you very, very
much
for being here.
God bless you.
Yes.
Thank you, Bob, very much, and Happy New Year to you.
You bet. You're listening to Don't Touch That Dial on KPFK Los Angeles.